Cornyn, 103.3 in Lake Geneva, WPR News from Gateway Technical College.
Today on...
This is WGTD HD serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program that's designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first Saturday of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show, we're going to talk about public cloud, private cloud, self-hosting, internal hosting, premise servers, and why you might want to choose one versus the other. And this is not going to be a covering of the topic that you have heard of before, because I'm going to be including information that is coming from the new expert, and what I mean by new, a newly recognized but very long-time expert in this technology, so newly recognized that the company that is doing this new perspective, on a very public fashion, I might add, is literally the certification company that is being used by Lloyd's of London Insurance to decide whether or not a public cloud or a cloud hosting provider can actually be insured. Oh, well, that's interesting. So let's dive into that. Let's just establish some baseline of understanding here. So historically, there are things called like legacy workloads. It's where you would have your own servers on premise and you would run those, you would run various workloads there. Well, if you want to have a specific workload, like Great Plains is a great example of this. Great Plains is a piece of technology that does not work without other dependent technologies being in place and in good working order. So that's going to mean at least two domain controllers and a certificate authority server. And then in the event that an organization was of reasonable size, they were then also going to have an AD Connect server. So let's see, we got a Great Plains server, at least. You're probably going to have a backup management server. Then you have to have two domain controllers. And then you're having to have that certificate authority server there. So this is quite a lot. Then let's now take a look at whether the server is hosted in the cloud or in your premise facility. What are the actual maintenance costs of maintaining those systems? So I'm just talking maintenance. I'm not talking about any sort of software. I'm talking about professional, competent management, patching, backup, vulnerability management, proper levels of documentation, proactive maintenance, lifecycle asset management on the hardware, just really good, appropriate management, professional management, of course, endpoint protection management, SOC and NOC, monitoring, these sorts of things. For a typical virtual machine, that's going to be about $3,000 a year. For a physical server, that's going to be about $6,000 a year. Now, the reasoning for that difference is because when you're talking about a physical server, the physical server also has other components which need to be maintained. And it just takes longer to do stuff on a physical server simply because the physical server is almost always hosting some volume of virtual servers. So for example, if you're going to reboot a physical server, you will probably have to be shutting down a bunch of virtual machines first. And then there's the factors that have to also be professionally managed, which are like power management, interfacing with power management systems. So all of these things turn into a dollar amount for that is just going to be there for competent management of those assets, whether they are in the public cloud or whether they're on-premise, with the exception of some of the hardware management stuff. Okay, so you're looking at least $3,000 a year per virtual machine to have it actually really competently managed. Anybody who tells you that a Windows server can be patched for $50 a month is misleading you, because they're not patching it for $50 a month. Or if they are, they're using really inexpensive labor in a foreign country. And I guess the question you would have to ask yourself is, do you trust the competency of that? And then are you comfortable with those personnel having admin access to those servers? These are questions only you can answer. So that turns into the economics of some of that differentiation, at least as a historical understanding. And what people would do is they would look at the cost of capital expenditure of servers on-premise versus renting workloads. And when I have done an analysis on Microsoft Azure, 18 months in Azure is equivalent to 7 years on-premise. And yes, I'm very serious about that. I'm including, you know, power, facility, property tax, all of that. Now keep in mind, the stuff that you're paying for in cloud, you're paying sales tax on that every month as well. Versus if you had just paid for your equipment on-premise, you're not paying sales tax on that every month. You know, you paid your use tax one time when you purchased it, and that's it. Now you have that equipment. You're not, like, renting it every month. What do you need to have on-premise, though, for that on-premise equipment to be effective? Well, it has to be competently managed. So if your scenario is that it's not competently managed, you just don't have the staff for that, you know, or if your uptime requirements are such that personnel need to actually be able to get to the stuff in a timely fashion, can you get people to that equipment within a half an hour? And don't make an assumption that your IT service provider should somehow respond faster than what a full-time internal employee at your company would do. Don't do that. I think that's not necessarily reasonable. I've seen a lot of people have higher expectations, but yet not necessarily want to pay for that 24/7 service. It can be way more cost-effective for you to take a physical server that you have and host it in somebody else's data center, assuming that your operations are large enough. But most colos, this is what they call them, is a co-location space where you take your physical server and that, they're going to be over $1,500 a month. So in a lot of cases, that's not that cost-effective unless you have a really big server with a lot of workloads. Okay, well, you know, there's a lot of nuance to this. Here's what the new information is, though, that I find to be shocking. Not unexpected, by the way. Not unexpected, but shocking. And I think it turns a lot of these things that were baseline assumptions on their head. A lot of people have been looking at AWS, Azure, you know, outsourced cloud hosting for conventional server workloads, right? I'm not talking about something that's Kubernetes. I'm talking about a conventional server workload. And they make an assumption. And that assumption is that their data center, cloud, colo, public cloud, or whatever they are, whatever that little hosting provider, well, really, none of them are little, but that hosting provider is doing a competent job. And this is where that pile of assumptions falls apart. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Eric Woodell who is running an organization called Ameris. And his background is 20 plus years in the physical data center and infrastructure industry. And he used to work for a very major organization that had significant assets that were in many, many, many different public cloud sort of hosted spaces as well as colos. So as part of that experience, he had to audit their operations. And the baseline audit that a lot of people tend to look at is SOC 2. Now let's talk about that a bit, because Eric Woodell has a very distinct opinion about SOC 2. So SOC 2 is an audit that is conducted by accountants, CPAs. And in that audit, they're basically looking at things and assessing things, things that they really are not of great grand expertise in. In my opinion, as well as Dr. Woodell's opinion, a person probably shouldn't be auditing items that they can't build and design and maintain from scratch themselves. So the inherent qualification of a CPA auditing a data center and their operations and their maintenance logs, are they doing what they should be doing? These things are not necessarily in alignment. And in his opinion, what he found from extensive years and years of audits of data centers and colos is that these third-party vendors were not fulfilling their obligations for doing appropriate maintenance. And he's got some lovely publications that he's written, some of which he has this great metaphorical analysis for, and is effectively making it very easy for people to understand. And he says that if the aviation industry had an equivalent level of failures as the data center industry has with regards to severe outages that equate to a catastrophic crash, then there would be approximately 530 plane crashes per day. My goodness. Well, at those statistics, probably no one would ever get on an airplane again. So when we think about that kind of a factor, and I'll just keep in mind, I'm going to refresh your memory on this. If you think he's not correct, you would be wrong. Because Lloyd's of London, right? If you like don't believe me, because I've looked into his work, but if you don't believe me, then understand the fact that Lloyd's of London is using his certification program to assess whether or not a data center risk is insurable. So if the data center risk is too high, it's not going to be insurable. And Lloyd's of London certainly knows what they're doing with regards to insurance. So because of these factors, I do believe in his numbers and calculations where he's saying if the aviation industry had an equivalent number of catastrophic crashes equivalent to what's happening in data centers, then there would be approximately 530 plane crashes per day. So I think that this bears some very significant thought, because it really dramatically challenges the underlying presumptions of reliability that were at the core of the presumption of outsourcing these workloads. I mean, access to support is definitely a thing that is a concern. Let's say you're a law firm in California, and that law firm in California doesn't have a staff of 10 highly qualified, very highly experienced information technology security professionals, plus their own CTO. Okay, so that definitely makes sense for them to outsource that. But then if you are looking at where should we host these workloads so that the people who need to support those workloads, who are competent to manage those workloads, are able to get to those workloads, well, now that becomes a matter of it's either going to be in a colo that they can get to, or it's going to be in some sort of a fully remote, cloud-controlled situation, of which there is definitely a higher cost associated with that. But that higher cost can be, you know, offset by the risk of just not being able to get competent people to manage it. So we have to be focused here on this thing of, I'm going to say three factors: vendor risk management, counterparty risk management, and the underlying assumption of competency. So those three are very interrelated, but you can't start using a service that you haven't defined the underlying competency of that service delivery. So it is important to have those workloads be where they are able to be supported by competent individuals. But because of the work of Dr. Eric Weddell, the whole foundational underlying assumption that cloud-hosted anything is sufficiently reliable is deeply in question. So that underlying assumption is deeply in question. I had the pleasant experience of being able to interview Dr. Weddell for quite a duration, and that will be that is another Breakfast Bites show that is available online because it's rather lengthy. And in that, it became very clear to me, based upon everything that he was saying, which I agreed with because it resonated with everything that I had as personal experience in the IT services industry or the IT infrastructure industry for the last 30 years, is this aspect of the real requirement baseline you have to start with is vendor risk management, counterparty risk management, you know, supportability and competency. So we already talked about the supportability piece. You have to put the workloads where competent people can support them. I think the days are gone where you can just assume that somebody can go drive someplace and take care of something. Those days are kind of gone. And it's getting harder and harder and harder to find competent personnel. Well, now let's pivot to this whole thing of counterparty risk management, vendor risk management. I've had conversations recently with some insurance executives. Those insurance executives had filled me in on how the situation is changing in the insurance industry and the new requirement we all should be expecting in the typical renewal time period. And I can tell you that most cyber insurance and E&O policies seem to renew starting around December, January timeframe. And when I mean renewal, I'm talking about like that becomes the process, the start of the process, at least the start of the process that's driven from the insurance company or the broker. So, you know, real premium renewal might be something like March every year, but you know, you have to back into that with some months of preparation. So this big new shift of their focus is going to be about vendor risk management, counterparty risk management, third-party information security risk management. And what I think a lot of people are going to be seeking is to try to use the same approach that they've used for employment for a long time. You know, in employment, you say, oh, do you have a bachelor's degree? Do you have this certification? Do you have that certification? And that somehow those things are supposed to be a delineator between one candidate and another. Well, in the data center space, SOC 2 certification is supposed to be that delineator. But again, I go back to Dr. Eric Weddell's publications on this very topic. SOC 2 certifications are done by CPAs. They're not actually done by infrastructure architects. So in his opinion, and he's not the only one that has this opinion, in his opinion, which I find to be highly credible, the SOC 2 certification is not worth the digital paper that it's written on. And I have heard that opinion emanating from people that I've respected for at least the last decade. It seems to be a desire amongst business decision makers to try to find the check the box exercise. You know, we don't know how to differentiate between, you know, one vendor or another, so we're going to look to some certification. So the SOC 2 certification becomes a check the box exercise. And that's more of a check the box exercise than something like ISO 27001, which, you know, has more kind of meat and potatoes to it. So one of the takeaways you need to have is that SOC 2 certification is not and should not be used as a delineator between competency and incompetency. In fact, it's not really a delineator of anything other than the fact that this company went through some motions and they found a CPA firm to provide them a certification. And this would really be not that different from Arthur Anderson certifying an Enron books, you know. Okay. So these are things, is it perspectives that you need to have as you're going through this process that then turns into you really need to have third-party information security risk management. And in the HIPAA space, let me just address the HIPAA space briefly. I found in a lot of cases in the HIPAA space, they want the business associate agreement thing. They want the BAA. And sometimes the BAA is just not appropriate. It's not required at all. Most of the time I find where executives in the healthcare industry are not real clear around the delineations, whether this BAA certification or this BAA agreement is even appropriate to be used. They just kind of default, de facto, want to use it for everything. And there's a cost to that. And there's a risk to that. So there's a risk to asking people to certify or attest to a particular status when that status isn't applicable. But there's also a risk in the over-reliance on something like that. Like, does having a BAA in place actually accomplish anything? Well, that's an interesting debate for another show. What we found out here from the work of Dr. Eric Woodell is he is a data scientist in addition to being somebody who understands the technology exceptionally well. And so because of him being a data scientist, he also has excellent statistical evidence and numerical proof of the assertions that he makes. And that has added to a level of credibility in what he's saying. In addition to that, he's basically gone through some major vetting processes with Lloyd's of London, who some might argue is the largest, most long-running insurance company in the entire world. And if Lloyd's of London is relying upon his compliance certification program to make their risk management decisions, that's something to pay attention to. Okay, so SOC 2 certification, be very cautious about what it is that you need that for. Now, I think this becomes really, really important even on like the vendor side. So on the vendor side, you may be getting as part of like an RFP, you may be getting a request for your, you know, the results of your last SOC 2 audit. Okay, well, did you ever need to go through a SOC 2 audit? Did you go through a SOC 2 audit? Does it add any value to you to go through a SOC 2 audit? Is the company that's asking for your SOC 2 results, what are they actually trying to evaluate? So I find this vendor risk management process, I think this is the new frontier that's going to be coming to the front and center. And again, I hear this from the insurance people, but it's also my observation that there's a whole lot of theater going on in both directions. The theater of relying upon compliance certifications that basically mean nothing, and then the desire on the prospective customer side to think that they are transferring liability by asking for these certifications when in reality it does not result in them transferring any liability nor mitigating any risk. So it's just a wasted effort. But on the vendor side, they are wasting time and energy going through theatrical processes that are not actually reducing their risk or providing economic value to them. Great example of that, and probably the best example of that, is going to be the written information security plan that we all have become well aware of in the space of tax preparers. I believe it also applies to accountants, and it also applies to like car dealerships and anybody that's doing significant financial transactions or handling financial and sensitive related data of a financial nature of consumers, okay, of consumers, private individuals. So you see car dealerships are dealing with a lot of, you know, transactions with individuals, and a lot of like merchants can offload their risk associated with PCI by not doing the PCI transactions themselves, but by having that process through an external vendor. But your tax preparers and accounting firms, you know, they're handling those transactions. So according to the Federal Trade Commission and IRS standards and regulations, is that they have to have a written information security plan. My argument as a CISO is, does your written information security plan actually correlate with reality? Or is it a piece of fiction? What legal defensibility have you achieved if your written information security plan is not in alignment with reality? How would you know that your WISP, the written information security plan, how would you know that the WISP is in alignment with reality? Well, it would have had to have been reviewed and revised by someone who understands both sides of that topic. One side are the technical controls and the actual real technical and process and security risk management outcomes. The other side is the business side. Versus what I tend to see in almost all cases is where somebody goes to the internet and they get a template and they massage that template and they make it look all pretty, but there's no review and revision process engaged in by the right people who have the capability to make that happen. And so what you end up with is WISP theater. And that does not confer legal defensibility. There's a recent lawsuit that is a class action lawsuit, and if you're interested in this, Joe Brunsman has a wonderful YouTube channel, and he is a cyber insurance and errors and omissions insurance broker. He has this wonderful YouTube channel, and one of the things that he talks about in this, in his recent video, is he's talking about the aspects of this class action lawsuit, some of which are arguments that because the breached company did not do their due diligence and due care, they did not have a legally defensible suite of actions that they had conducted and completed, that the argument of the plaintiffs is unjust enrichment by the executive management team. And I think there's merit to that argument. And they, of course, there's a lot more data in there, and I would encourage you to listen to his show. And again, that is Joe Brunsman on YouTube. So I think the focus, my prediction for 2025, is that the focus really needs to pivot to real integrity processes around vendor risk management, third-party risk management, and I will leave you to contemplate that.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first Saturday of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, go to her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.